Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the Church.
We welcome you again to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm Brent Topp, your host, and I am the chair of the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University. I'm glad to once again have with us on our program today Dr. Fred Woods. Fred, we're grateful to have you again with us on Past Impressions.
Thank you so much.
In our last episode, Fred, we talked about kind of the gathering to the Nauvoo period, but also now as we shift gears and start the gathering in the later period, as they're still coming across the Atlantic Ocean, what are some of the challenges that they're facing? Not only we talked a little bit about storms and things like that, but what about challenges that the saints are facing with the Gentiles, or what are the challenges that they're facing on the ships and then later on steamboats and other kinds of things? Let's pick up with that.
It's a good question. I think our listeners ought to understand that whatever they could charter a voyage with just Latter-day Saints, they would do so. And one of the reasons I think for that is because sometimes these salty sailors would want to mix with the LDS sisters a bit more than the brethren wanted. And so the priesthood played a very important role. And some of them figured out along the way, you mean if I become a brother, I can be with the sisters? And so it's interesting to read. I'm thinking of the Marshfield in 1854 that we have. When they would arrive in the ports, cities, they would write a letter back saying, you know, births, marriages, deaths, and the highlights of the trip. And one of the things they would, want to report is the conversions and things. And I thought it was interesting in one Millennial Star report that I found that the comment by John D. McAllister is that we could have converted, you know, all of the sailors, but but our captain, Mormon captain leader, was too old for them, meaning too wise, because they had found that some of them were faking conversion in order to be with the sisters. So then after that, they were saying they'd make them wait until they came to shore. But there are some great legitimate conversion experiences. It's interesting to I'm thinking of the ship, the Olympus in 1851, where we have William Howell as the company leader, and the captain comes to him and says, you know, you better be saying your prayers and that pretty darn fast because we're going to be at the bottom of the ocean. So they have a special prayer, end up getting like 48 conversions out of that. And another great conversion story happens. This is in 1853 on board the International, okay? David Brown, the captain from Mystic Seaport, fighting a storm for 2 days. He's exhausted and he has a dream that he and his other mates are going to be converted by these Mormons. And sure enough, 18 out of 19 were converted, and the saints were so excited about all this that on April 6th of 1853, in the middle of the Atlantic, they had quite a celebration about the anniversary of the church as well as these conversions. And I think the funnest thing I found in my study over the years is this song that it was written by Henry Mabin for that occasion. And it just – the music really gives you a feeling for the gathering, and I'm just going to risk – maybe I'll just share one verse with you to give a feeling for this. But it was sung to the tune of Yankee Doodle, and it goes like this, just to capture that feeling of the gathering. On board the International, all joyful and glad-hearted, were Zion-bound 400 saints. From Liverpool we started, were English, Irish, Scotch, and Welsh, assembled there together, proposed to do the will of God, whate'er the wind and weather. Then sing aloud, ye saints of God, in one united chorus. Old Babylon we'll leave behind, for Zion is before us.
Oh, love it, Fred. We ought to have an immigration album from you. That is great. And so as we now shift into the 1850s and gathering to Canesville and then on to the Salt Lake Valley, and ultimately there are going to be other stopping points along the way, there's a change in, I guess we would call, technology. The technology of sailing changes a little bit. Why don't you share with us how steam now changes the immigration process?
It's going to have a huge impact. As I mentioned, 54 days from Liverpool to New Orleans. Now with the shift of things, they're going to be going to the East Coast commencing in 1855 because of the threat of yellow fever and cholera. Brigham Young sends a letter to Liverpool. The apostles there saying, look, we're losing too many. It's a threat. So he says, use Boston, Philadelphia, or New York. And so this timeline by sail from Liverpool to say, New York was an average of 38 days. And yet with steam power, they can do it in 11 days. Mm. So it really has quite an impact.
And so it changes the dynamics of it because it now makes it shorter. But we also are now going to be using various ports. Why don't you tell us about why they chose the ports that they did, and then how that affects the later on the trail part?
Yeah, well, the Eastern Seaboard is where we're going to get most of the European immigrants in general in the mid-19th century. But in 1855, New York, in fact, over 65,000 of the 90,000 come into New York. And the main reason is because they have just created this immigration depot that's known as Castle Garden. So Ellis Island won't come along until 1892. And I think a lot of our Latter-day Saints think that Ellis Island, every time they're coming in, it's Ellis Island, and it's not. It's Castle Garden that burned down in 1889 is where the bulk of them are going to be coming into. But we also had, it's interesting, we had agents at these different ports I mentioned. So at Castle Garden, you had as early as 1855, John Taylor. He has his Mormon periodical called The Mormon. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful. The last decade, I have been entrenched going to church archives and looking at the correspondence between, you know, someone like Franklin D. Richards with John Taylor, with what's going on, you know, with the agents and Brigham Young. They do a masterful job of identifying, you know, who's coming, what their trades are, where they can get employment and lodging. I mean, sometimes it would take them months or even years to get to Zion because of not having enough money. But the church had a wonderful system to take care of the employment and the lodging because of this wonderful correspondence between Brigham Young and the agents.
Fred, we've been talking almost exclusively about the British saints coming to gather with the saints first in Nauvoo and then ultimately in winter quarters in Canesville. I have a special interest because of my own personal background is that I have ancestors from Denmark, and I served a mission in Denmark. And I know that in 1850, the missionary work was opened up in Scandinavia. And so what role now does missionary work in continental Europe and Scandinavia, how does that impact our immigration? And now we should be having a gathering of a lot of other saints. And how does that work when you're bringing them in with the Brits?
Well, this is a very, very exciting period of church history, the 1850s. And we have in Scandinavia, most of the converts are coming from Denmark. And it's interesting, they'll come down the Kattegat and into Copenhagen is the main mission home there. And what they'll do, I mean, now we have the issue of language coming mm-hmm. into play, which is a challenge for the agents in Liverpool. But again, we have this correspondence. So after gathering to Copenhagen, they're going to make their way across the Baltic Sea over to Kiel, Germany, take a train down to the Elbe River at Hamburg there, out the Elbe River, across the North Sea. They'll come into Hull or Grimsby, and then they'll take a train ride of 3 hours into Liverpool. So it's, as Mulder says, it's a series of journeys. But again, we have the agent in Copenhagen under the direction of one of the 12, and then we'll have agents that are being employed by the church to assist them. But they're going to, again, merge together, whether they're coming from Norway or Sweden, Scandinavian, even Iceland. They're going to have these groups meet together in Liverpool. About 85% of all the voyages in the 19th century are coming out of Liverpool. And that's, you know, we look at both. We haven't really had time to talk about the Pacific, but the Atlantic and the Pacific, they're really coming out of there. And this is an exciting time. I love to read these voyages of the Scandinavians, especially during the period of the Civil War. But I love this one account. There was a Peter Godfredson, and so he's talking about this crusty captain that says to Brother Peterson on the 1862 voyage of the John J. Boyd. The captain notes, if I hadn't these darn Mormons on board, I would have been in New York 6 weeks ago. And Peterson replied, if you hadn't had Mormons on board, you would have been in hell 6 weeks ago. So most of the time, as we, you know, the captains liked having the Mormon cargo because it ensured safety. And they were definitely superstitious about this. But there were a few crusty captains. The infamous Captain Schill, another one I'm thinking of, that told one of our Mormon leaders, Lillenquist, another Dane, he said that, Lillenquist was complaining because they'd lost 38 passengers to measles and the provisions were terrible. And Lillenquist wrote in his journal that if the captain would have had, Schill would have had the opportunity to throw him overboard, that he would have done so. But that was the exception to the rule. But the Scandinavian journals, I'm working right now on a massive four-year project just focusing on Icelandic and gathering Icelandic manuscripts in Utah. But then one of my colleagues, Scandinavian colleagues, who by the way is Catholic, we plan then to do a Danish accounts as well as Norwegian and Swedish. So this, we're in this for another 20 years anyway.
Wow, amazing. You know, one of the things that during this time period where you have the European saints and the British saints, and they're gathering together, and this is also going to be kind of the handcart period as well. And so we're leading up to a lot of these things during the 1850s. And so you have various outfitting posts that we're using to prepare them for the trail to the Great Salt Lake.
So true. So, you know, they're using these different ports and making their way over the in the like 47, 48, they're going to winter quarters, 49 to 52, they're going into Canesville. And so in those early years, again, they're coming into New Orleans and they're taking a left turn at St. Louis, going up the Missouri, which was, you know, as the saying went, a boy could handle the Mississippi, but it took a real man to handle the Big Muddy, the Missouri. And it's interesting, in 1852, I mentioned there were no, you know, we don't have the disasters crossing the ocean, crossing the Atlantic, but we had this this terrible steamboat explosion in 1852 on board of the steamboat Saluda. And this is very, very interesting to me because there was a warning that was given with regards to going aboard that vessel that wasn't heated. And anyway, during that time period, we lost over two dozen saints. But the silver lining to this is this is about an hour to the west of Jackson County where we had earlier problems. But the people in Lexington, Missouri, they hear the explosion. You know, this is where it took place, right on the river there, the river bend. And instead of finishing the Mormons off, you know, because remember, there's still the extermination order that was launched in 1838. They're going to go down and assist them with they were terribly burned, a number of them. They're going to bury the dead. They're going to raise funds to send them on to Utah. They're going to take them into their homes. They're going to have an orphan fund. But this compassion that you see in Lexington, it probably best cap, you know, really condensed in a remark by Abraham Smoot, who said, "I will never forget the kindness that was shown by the people of Lexington in taking care of the saints." So it's a time, I think, a beginning of a healing in that area of Missouri. And it's interesting now, we know not far from Lexington, we have a temple coming up in the Liberty area. But I like to generate light instead of heat. And I love to tell the story of the Saluda, because what really was a tragedy ended up, you know, having that silver lining, because so much goodwill came out of that.
And healing. That's great. Today on Past Impressions, we're talking with Dr. Fred Woods, professor of church history and doctrine. Fred, you talked about the very touching and tragic but also inspiring story of the explosion of the steamboat Saluda. And I know that affected a little bit of our of the challenges that we had in some of the steamboat travel and the outfitting posts. Why don't we talk and pick up there with some more of the outfitting posts and how they changed their plans of where they were going to go and how they were going to get with the saints. So why don't we pick up with that again?
Sounds good. Well, I think it's important to understand that the saints were always trying to get the best deal they could, whether it was sail, rail, or trail. Brigham Young, the American Moses, was so gifted with his ability to bring a people into the Salt Lake Valley. And he had these incredible agents, as I said earlier, that were posted at places like New Orleans or also on the East Coast. One really fun story that on the happening in New Orleans is when we have Lucius Scoville. Mm-hmm. In fact, we have Scoville's Bakery out of Nauvoo.
I was going to say that ought to be a familiar name to Latter-day
yes,
Saints.
Yes, and I would call this the letter of the law. It kind of reminds me of the story of Nephi being told to take off the head of Laban, because he gets down there at the time of the California Gold Rush wishing he was in California. And not having much money, Brigham sends him down there. He wants to be obedient. And to make a long story short, he has the impression that he should go to Calaboose Square, that's in the French Quarter of New Orleans, and buy a lottery ticket. And he's thinking, wow, you know, I don't gamble. And he has the impression again. He goes down, asks the man at this bookstore that he's directed to about this. And he said, oh, we don't sell, you know, we don't sell lottery tickets. And, you know, and he presses him on. And he says, well, I guess we do. And he looks at the tickets. I can still remember the number from his journal. It was 9998. Puts all his money on the table. And finds out 2 weeks later that he won 10 times the amount of money. And that's what he used to bring the saints through that season. You probably wouldn't hear this kind of a talk in general conference. But so you see these things with the agents. It's interesting, as you mentioned earlier, how it's going to change from year to year. So 49 to 52, Canesville. And then we get into 53, they actually go to Keokuk.
Which is right across the river, just downriver from Nauvoo.
Yes. And this is interesting because remember that the Missouri River, even in section 61, we know from Joseph Smith's Book of Revelations, is called the River Destruction.
Uh-huh.
And it was a danger. It was more dangerous than Mississippi, not only because of disease, but these bends and things. And it's interesting to me that because of the explosion of the steamboat Saluda, with this boiler explosion in 52, they're not going to take the Missouri. They think, you know what, let's go straight up, bypass St. Louis, where they had important agents there like Nathaniel Felt and James Hart and others, and they went up to Keokuk. But they only used Keokuk for one single year, 1853. Why? Because they thought, we don't want another 300 miles of crossing Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And so what did they do the next year? They went back to Missouri, and interestingly enough, just outside of Independence, Missouri at Westport, there in the Jackson County area, is where they had the their outfitting for that year. And then the following year, Mormon Grove in Kansas. Again, they're looking for the best deal, edging their way up. And then they're going to flip all the way over to Iowa City in 1856 because the railroad has mm-hmm. connected from the East Coast to that point, and that's where they're going to pick up the hand carts.
Okay, so the saints that are coming from Europe and British Isles, they go to the regular ports in the East Coast and then take the trail? Or how do they get to Iowa City?
Yeah, so this is an important thing. So again, the disease is going to change things on the Mississippi-Missouri River. 1855, they start going to the East Coast. In that same year, Castle Garden in New York, this is where most of them will come through. Then they're going to take a train. This is where we get that rail segment from the East Coast all the way out to Iowa City. And it's, again, interesting the role that the agents play. I can't emphasize this enough, the men in motion that are helping the saints, whether they're Scandinavian or British or whatever, they play such a key role. They're correspondents by sail, rail, and trail during this mid 19th century.
So the rail then becomes a very prominent feature in this gathering episode.
Absolutely, and especially with 1869, I wanted to just plug the DUP, Daughters of the Utah Pioneers. They have been so cooperative in helping me with my researches, but I've really enjoyed that the fact that they do not count a pioneer after 1869. Why? Well, by 1867, we have steam power across the ocean that the Mormons are using. By 69, we have the Transcontinental Railroad completed. And so now you can cross America in 9.5 days rather than several months. And so our good sisters of the DUP say, hey, we're cutting that baby off at 1869, because really now if you're going 11 days across the Atlantic to New York and then you're going another, you know, I mean, it's a 3-week trip as opposed to several months. And so that's going to be their cutoff for the pioneers. But of course, they continue to come by sail and rail in towards the rest of the 19th century.
At the tail end of that immigration process that we've been talking about, we have a major problem in the United States that's going to affect that, and that's the Civil War. And what role did the Civil War play in the gathering of the saints to Zion, and particularly how did it affect those foreign saints in their experiences?
Well, this is my very favorite time period, this 1861 to 65 segment, because it becomes this is high adventure. You know, it is very, very interesting where we have keep in mind the Millennial Star is being published when the war breaks out. We have Joseph Smith's revelation on war, particularly the Civil War in Section 87. So the saints are reading this. Missionaries are carrying it in their pocket, you know, as early as, 1832 and going into places like the South. But now we have Brigham Young, his talks being given in the tabernacle where the only place you're going to be safe is nestled in Zion. And the idea why everybody's fighting each other in America, the saints have this wonderful haven. This is going to have an impact. Some people might think that the immigration would have gone down. It was at an all-time high during the Civil War years because of this idea going back, I think, really to Section 29 of the Doctrine and Covenants, in which the Lord said to gather because of the calamities that were going to be coming out, you know, on the earth. So they're thinking, I mean, Millennial Star is called Millennial Star because of the millennium that's right around the corner in their mind. But it's so fun to read the accounts of crossing the ocean where they'd come up to some Confederate vessel and they'd say something like this: "You better say your prayers, Mormons, because you're going down. You're going down." And here we have these European saints looking in the eyes of a huge cannon and some vessel like the Confederate vessel like the Alabama that is threatening to blow them away. And then they think, no, maybe we shouldn't because of the implications of the war that we have saints writing about in other journals. By the time they get to land, they're going to be checking the Mormons for gunpowder. They're not quite sure what their stance is out west. They're going to do things like try to steal these beautiful Scandinavian women. They're going to be shooting cannonballs. When they go through Missouri, it is something else because they're riding in the Hannibal and St. Joe Railroad, and they're shooting cannonballs over their heads, okay? They're ripping up the track, this guerrilla warfare by Quantrell and the boys. When they get to St. Joe, the military gets a dollar per head that they can force into the military. When they get to Fort Bridger, they make the Mormons put their right arm to the square and swear an allegiance to the Constitution. So this time period by land and by sea is very, very interesting.
That is. I think that's a part of our history that is probably not very known at all. And I think that's incredible, and I appreciate the great work that you've done there. And so as we now gather them during this period, and especially in this latter period, we have the handcart companies in the 50s, and we get the rail and getting them back. But that isn't really the end of the challenges. The saints now are coming from all over Europe and the British Isles and eastern states, and they're gathering to what we now have as Utah. What are the challenges that they now face when you have all these international saints coming together in the Rocky Mountains?
Well, I think one of the things that you find, even though they have these challenges of language mm-hmm. and employment, you're going to have help from the saints in Utah to receive them. In fact, not only do they don't just wait for them to come to Salt Lake City, but we have, again, commencing with the Civil War years, we have these down and back wagon trains that come out. So they'll meet them at the Missouri River. And it's fun because I'm thinking as I'm jiggling my keys here that you have some of these teenage boys that look at an opportunity to get the keys to the car or uh-huh. dad's wagon with the horses. And they're going to go out with provisions to the Missouri River commencing in 1861, and they get the dibs on these beautiful Scandinavian babes that are coming into the valley.
So there's the motivation to do the service project.
Yeah, here I am, send me, right? So it's a very interesting thing. And then when they come in, they're going to come into Union Station as well as other places that are selected. And there will be people, family to meet them, saints that they've known in Germany, Switzerland, wherever. And they it's interesting how there's this support system and very, very powerful. However, some of them that didn't know somebody had – I'm thinking of Frederick Zog that really didn't have family. He was only 15. He comes in, and as he comes, he ends up coming up to north of Salt Lake into Brigham City area, and he asks a man that's supposed to pick him up they've never met, you know, is this Zion? And then his comment was, if you make it so. Mm. And, you know, Joseph and Brigham both warned, don't expect perfection. Mm-hmm. Most of the saints, you know, there's saints and then there's saints without halos. But most of the time they had this support system decision where the bishop would say, I need this many bricklayers, I need this many blacksmiths in a certain area. But there was this system to help them to assimilate throughout, which it was the spoonful of sugar, although they still had changes. I mean, how would it feel to come into Salt Lake City and all of a sudden be called up to Las Vegas where it was so dry that the lizards were wearing canteens to start a settlement? And so it's just, you know, 350 colonies, 86% will be successful. But so this is important.
That's an inspiring story. Thank you so much, Fred, for your expertise, your spirit of your discussion. We hope that our listeners will continue to listen to episodes of Past Impressions, where we study the people, places, events, and key issues associated with the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm Brent Topp, your host, saying goodbye till we meet again in talking about these important historical issues.